Hello, and welcome to the Doc Talk podcast. Though the disorder we now call sickle cell disease has been present in Africa for over 5,000 years, the medical community regards 1910 as the year that it was officially discovered. The first formal diagnosis occurred not in Africa, but the United States, and a young dental student named Walter Clement Noel. That was over 100 years ago. What do we know about sickle cell today? Well, for starters, the CDC has reported that about one in every 13 Black infants in the United States are born with a trait for sickle cell disease. Additionally, diagnosis and screening is still lacking in lesser resourced parts of Africa and the US alike. In an interview with the American Lung Association's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Dr. Ife Asunkwo spoke of the mechanism of the disease and its global burden. She noted that advancements in vaccine programs, newborn screening, breakthroughs in chronic therapy, and more have all contributed to bridging the equity gap and helping patients live longer and healthier lives. But there's still more work to be done, and who better to explain that than Dr. Asunkwo. Let's listen in now.
I guess depending on one's training and practice demographics, as well as having a level of suspicion, sickle cell disease is not something that all physicians seem to recognize or for that matter feel comfortable treating. Can you comment on that at all?
Yeah, you're right. So it affects mostly people of African descent. So I grew up in Nigeria where everybody around was of the same ethnicity. And there's a 25% prevalence of the traits in our community. So almost every doctor should know or would know about sickle cell disease. Coming back to the United States after medical school, I realized that the prevalence is geographically distributed across the country. So it's not equal. The Southeast, the Northeast, and then the Texas and California have the largest population of sickle cell disease. If you live in the middle belt of the country, you may not see that many sickle cell individuals. If you live in rural areas or smaller cities, you may not see that much sickle cell disease. So growing up in New York and training in New York and New Jersey, there was a lot of sickle cell disease in those large cities because a lot of immigrants come there. But South Carolina, North Carolina, they do have it, but it's not as widely spread as you would expect in, you know, New York, New Jersey, or even Florida.
So although trained as a pediatrician, I understand your current practice of sickle cell disease spans childhood into adult years. Can you please discuss the treatment and chronic management and how these things have changed over the last several decades? I know recently the FDA approved two new drugs back in 2019, Voxelotor and Crizanlizumab, I believe I pronounced it correctly.
Sure. So, you know, sickle cell disease used to be a disease that killed children in their infancy. So the under five mortality is extremely high in countries like Nigeria or sub-Saharan Africa. With newborn screening and with penicillin prophylaxis and a good vaccine program in the US, the average lifespan of sickle cell disease has actually improved to 45, 48 years for SS and mid 50s for SC. So imagine a workforce that was initially trained and designed to treat children who would often die before they became adults. We didn't quite catch up with the fact that they're living a little bit longer. And so there was a lot less adult providers trained to take care of sickle cell disease in the US and other resource rich countries. So my practice was as a pediatric hematologist because, you know, in Nigeria, they were all children. So I went into the pediatric route. Coming back here, I realized when my children grew up and finished high school with sickle cell disease, they were stuck in this no man's land without providers to take care of them. And I began to see more of my teenagers up until their mid 20s. And my most recent job in Charlotte, North Carolina, they actually hired me to help them build an adult sickle cell program because there was nobody around who felt comfortable, who felt competent, or had the expertise to manage sickle cell disease in an aging population. It's kind of funny because I talk to people about my patient demographic and I have an 18-year-old and an 80-year-old in the same clinic day with sickle cell disease, right? It's quite gratifying. However, in many parts of the world, we still have a very high under five mortality. So the treatment of sickle cell disease really starts at birth. You want to make sure you can detect that they have sickle cell disease before they turn 2 months, because at that time, the risk of mortality from infection is extremely high. So newborn screening is universal in the United States, and every baby born in this country, regardless of race, ethnicity, or gender will be screened, and we will detect sickle cell trait or sickle cell disease. And they will be referred to a hematologist from within the first week of life. So the idea being by age 2 months, you should be on penicillin prophylaxis and be plugged into a comprehensive sickle cell disease treatment care plan with a hematologist who is specialized in sickle cell disease. Now, in other countries, that doesn't happen, but that's what the normal should be. That's the standard of care for sickle cell disease would be newborn screening, refer to hematology, start them on penicillin, and begin to teach the parents how to manage the disease and how to look for acute and chronic complications. So, you know, you go through the elementary years and you're giving them penicillin for 5 years, they get their vaccines. In 1998, the first drug that was approved for sickle cell disease was hydroxyurea. And we now have over 30 years of data that suggests that hydroxyurea is effective in reducing pain, acute chest syndrome, admissions to the hospital, transfusion burden, and prolonging life in children with sickle cell disease who have SS and S beta 0 thal. So the recommendation is that for every 9-month-old, you need to offer them hydroxyurea if they have sickle cell disease and not wait until they have a lot of problems, you know, before you offer them this really, really potent and effective medication. Of course, one drug cannot fix all the sickle cell problems. The pathophysiology is quite complicated. So in 2017, Endari or L-glutamine was approved by the FDA for sickle cell disease. And this is an amino acid protein that is used to treat sickle cell disease by changing the nitric oxide balance in the body and reducing chronic inflammation and oxidative stress. And the study showed that you reduce the number of admissions to the hospital or ER visits from 3 a year to 2 a year. And so that is, you know, 25% efficacy is clinically significant, even though people may not think it's as robust as hydroxyurea that drops it by 50%. So that became available in 2017 for all sickle cell genotypes. In 2019, they approved two drugs. One is Voxelotor, and what it does is it raises the hemoglobin level and helps to mitigate the hemolysis, which many sickle cell patients have. And then there's crizanlizumab that works by reducing the adhesivity of the cells in the bloodstream. So red blood cells and white blood cells and blood vessels kind of adhere together. It's a P-selectin inhibitor that kind of mitigates that adhesion and vaso-occlusion and reduces pain in sickle cell disease. And it's given once a month as an IV infusion to reduce pain crisis. And I think the data shows a 42% reduction in the median number of pain episodes a year. And it also reduces the days you spend in the hospital and it lengthens the time in between pain episodes. So that's what that's indicated for. Of course, we're looking for more and more drugs. And there's a lot of clinical trials right now out there looking at other either small molecules or other drugs that work either through hemoglobin F induction, which is how hydroxyurea works, or by reducing the hemoglobin and reducing hemolysis, increasing the hemoglobin and reducing hemolysis like Voxelotor, or a combination of those methods using the PKR activation pathway. So we hope that in the future, we would use a multi-drug therapy approach for sickle cell disease, because even with hydroxyurea, you still have breakthrough events, breakthrough pain, breakthrough acute chest syndrome, breakthrough strokes. And I don't want to forget talking about transfusion therapy, which has been around for years and years and years, and is a very, very effective way of treating acute sickle cell complications. And in some cases, preventing some of the chronic complications like recurrent stroke, organ damage, and acute chest syndrome. So in summary, that's pretty much what we have for sickle cell disease. It seems like a lot, but when you compare it to rheumatoid arthritis or diabetes, where you have like dozens of medications, we have a long way to go in providing more tools in the sickle cell treatment toolkit.
So aside from the breakthroughs in chronic therapy, I understand that stem cell or bone marrow transplants are really the only cure for sickle cell disease, but these are not done very often because of the risks involved. But I also thought and saw recently some articles specifically in the New England Journal of Medicine in December regarding gene therapy with something called lentiglobin. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. I think the first sickle cell individual treated with a stem cell transplant was in the mid-80s. And she had leukemia, was treated with a stem cell transplant for her sickle cell disease, for her leukemia, and her sickle cell disease got better. And so the research began to expand from then. Mass sibling bone marrow transplants is a way to cure sickle cell disease. It's most effective when you do it when you're younger. However, we've had 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds who underwent transplant from a max sibling and have done well. I think the data suggests a 93% overall survival for pediatrics and about an 81% overall survival for adults who undergo a massive lung transplant. But you have a challenge in terms of, do you have a matched sibling, right? So if you have a sickle cell child, you may not have another one with the same spouse because the risk of having another child is quite high. So that limits your options there. The other thing is that you do have a 3 to 5% chance of something really bad happening, either mortality or very severe GVHD. And of course, it's a very lengthy and demanding process to go through. So some people may not have the resources or the community support or family support to undergo that, that process. You know, over the years, they've explored alternative donor protocols. So looking at haplotransplants from your sibling or your parents, looking at mismatched transplants or unrelated transplants. And these have all been tried in sickle cell disease and have gone to where, the efficacy is pretty standard, right? So those are available if you can, meet the other criteria and also have the resources to pursue it. Now, in the past, maybe 5 to 7 years, looking at gene therapy as a way of curing their sickle cell disease is a way to provide transplantation or curative therapy to many, many more patients where you don't need a donor, which is a rate limiting step for transplantation, the traditional way. It's where you take your own cells, they manipulate it with viral vectors or other technology, they fix the mutation and they give it back to you and they cure your disease that way. So that's where the protocol you had just mentioned comes into play. I think it's Bluebird Bio that is working with folks at the NIH looking at a lentiglobin gene vector that will kind of modify your hemoglobin and you produce a hemoglobin that doesn't sickle and that can be used to cure your disease. We have patients who've undergone gene therapy and we've seen it to be effective, but the data is still kind of early to know what the longer term consequences could be. Are you gonna end up with mutational mutagenesis later on? We don't know. How long is this new gene gonna sustain in your bone marrow? We don't know. So we need more time to tell how long-term efficacy is gonna look like. But they're looking at newer and different technology where it's not just replacing the gene, it's also fixing the mutation at a single point using CRISPR-Cas9, using gene editing, gene deletion technology. Some people are trying to put in a hemoglobin F promoter in the gene, in the genetic map so that you can make more hemoglobin F. So there's different modalities that are being looked at. And I really am excited that in the future, we may have an opportunity to offer gene therapy to everybody, but it will take several years, maybe even a decade or more before it becomes mainstream for everybody. The other thing to think about is the cost, right? So just getting a bone marrow transplant can cost $250,000 for one person, right? So you have to think about how much it's going to cost. And that may be a rate limiting step for using your own stem cells to cure your sickle cell disease. But, it's progress and it's science, and there's hope, right? So there's going to be at some point a way around these obstacles, I believe.
So the American Lung Association has a long history of championing the nation's lung health, including addressing health disparities. Now, as sickle cell disease is primarily among the Black population, this seems to be patients who are a minority amidst the minority. Yeah. Can you address some of the issues of access to care, as well as some of the cultural issues of stigma, mistrust that develops, especially around new treatments and clinical trials in this population? How do you address them with such a clinic that you have in the population that you deal with?
How much time do we have to talk about this?
Feel free to
So when you think about health equity and health disparities, sickle cell falls in the middle of every single inequity and disparity that is out there, from a ethnic racial disparity, right? From a knowledge about the disease disparity. So most providers are very unaware of the nuances of sickle cell disease, right? From the economic disparity, they get sick, they end up not finishing school, they have poor educational attainment. So financially, they're in the lower socioeconomic status. And then in terms of health insurance, they have difficulty getting health insurance because the guidelines right now recommend, you can get Medicaid when you're young, when you turn 18, if you're not half dead, you can't get covered. So all my young adults are out there with no insurance. I mean, think about that. And then, African-American men or women who go to the ER and they have pain, they need opioids for their pain for sickle cell disease. And then there's a disparity there. They're dubbed as drug seekers or drug addicts and drug seeking. And it really causes a lot of emotional and psychological trauma that makes them want to stay away from healthcare, so then they don't access healthcare even when they can't access healthcare. And then two, it makes them distrust all healthcare. You know, even though I am Black, I still struggle with building trust with sickle cell patients because I have doctor by my name and I wear a white coat. So I have to buy that trust by building relationships with them and showing them that they can trust me. When it comes to clinical trials, there's a disparity there because one, they don't trust you. They've been treated bad by the healthcare system. They've been stigmatized. Why would they now subject themselves to experimental treatment from people that they don't really trust who have been treated in that, right? So you have to overcome the traditional African-American challenges with clinical trials from historical issues, and then also overcome the sickle cell barriers to clinical trials to get them to participate in something that may help build more treatment opportunities for them. So there's a lot of work being done in the community. We tend to work with sickle cell community agencies and have partnerships with the medical centers where we have dialogue. And it's a mutually beneficial relationship where they tell us what their problems are. We need ER standards, ER guidelines. We need people to respect the patients. And then we advocate for that inside the healthcare system. And then we educate them about sickle cell disease. Okay, sickle cell disease causes X, Y, Z. And this is why it's important for you to engage in healthcare and participate. And so it has to be a long game. You can't just think about, I have a trial, come and do my trial. No. You got to build this over years and years and years. And quite frankly, when I first came to Charlotte, it took me 3 years before we opened our very first sickle cell clinical trial because they did not trust the system. They wanted to know that, are you going to take care of me well if I say no to your clinical trial? Or are you going to hold me to ransom because I didn't say yes to your clinical trial? So you have to make sure that you are very transparent. You have to keep the lines of communication open. And you have to be willing to say you don't know and say, you know what, I was wrong. I mean, I've apologized to patients a lot on my behalf and on my system's behalf because they sometimes get really the short end of the stick. And as a minority person who also has have access healthcare, I have seen firsthand how it could be when it goes well, but also how it could be when it goes wrong. You know, and it's really good to empathize with them and say, you know what, I understand what you're saying. And my job as your provider is to be an advocate on your behalf, both within my circle and then outside of my circle.
Well, you have given us a lot of information, both clinically and also a lot of thought about what we have to do as a society to improve health disparities, especially a population such as the sickle cell people. Are you anything you would like to say in closing? This has been very helpful to me and I hope to many of our listeners as well.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for spotlighting sickle cell disease, lung complications, acute chest, and just sickle cell disease in general. In this webcast, I think that the more people are aware that sickle cell disease actually is still around, right? People are still being born every year. We have about 1,000 babies in the US being born every year. They are living longer. So there's going to be a point where every provider, be you a physician or an advanced practice provider, will have the privilege of seeing a sickle cell patient, both in the specialty setting, but also in primary care. I want to emphasize that sickle cell patients they can still have every medical complication that you or I are exposed to. They can get diabetes, they can get asthma, they can get high blood pressure, they can get gout, they can get STDs, you know, they can get, you know, arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, they can get lupus. And the practice of avoiding sickle cell disease by providers needs to stop because they deserve, you know, good care just like everybody else. And if you are not comfortable with sickle cell disease management as a provider, you know how to manage your regular medicine. Just do that. And then seek out experts who are sickle cell disease providers who kind of work with you in partnership. I encourage a lot of co-management. I am a hematologist, I'm not a primary care doctor. I don't know how to treat high blood pressure, but I can treat sickle cell disease. And I like to work with providers as partners to give the patient the best that they deserve. They do need their mammogram and their colonoscopy and their, you know, their pelvic screening. They need all of that and they need their sickle cell disease management. But there are options right now. And so no longer should we say that they're gonna die as kids. We want them to live long and healthy lives, and we can help them do that with the right kind of care team supporting them. And I joke about the fact that I want my patients to live to be 99 years, lose all their teeth, and use a walker, right? It's going to take a lot of work from all of us working together to be able to get there. But thank you so much, Dr. Rizzio, for this opportunity to talk.
Great message, and thank you.
You're welcome, sir. Okay.
We'd like to thank Dr. Osunkwo for being part of the program. And we want to thank you for listening. If you want more sickle cell disease news, follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. We'll be back next week with a new Doc Talk. But until then, stay safe and stay healthy.